Hello and welcome to another episode of Tyra Talks. Today's episode is going to essentially discuss the idea and meaning behind informed consent. And I think it's really important because currently, personally, I would define this current age as the age of understanding consent. And that is from various different angles, not just sexual, but also information and medical and essentially anything that governs your life and body, whether it comes to gender issues, whether it comes to, entitlement or identity or sexual choices, and last but by no means least, medical choices. And that's what I'm going to really sort of hone in on throughout these next the three episodes that I'm referring to, the three-part series, if you like. Now, it's something that I've been researching for quite some time now, I'd say around 2 years or so. And particularly more and more in depth over the past about 14 months, I'd say. So I'd say when you read about something every single day, literally, whether it's 10 minutes or 20 minutes or half an hour or 2 hours, your knowledge base does build up. Obviously, the more thorough you can research something, the better it is for you, right? But yeah, so I'm definitely going to focus on it. Now, what I would like to say is that I'm going to present the facts of these particular topics without a bias, without taking a stance, and without telling you what my opinion on it is. I will summarize based on fact as to what it means, what I have understood a particular paragraph, for instance, to mean, and that's all I will be doing. And the reason for that is because I think that it would be ironic for me to discuss something about consent and being informed about something, and then provide information to then persuade. To seek to persuade, which is not really my intention behind this. My intention behind this is purely to understand what consent is and how it affects our lives. And if that means that there is an element of our lives that we have not yet understood requires a certain level of consent, then perhaps this will be something that enables us to open our minds to it. And that's all I want to do, plant a seed. And if you feel that that seed need not be planted for you, or that seed doesn't need to grow any further for you, then that's absolutely fine. But there's no harm in discussing something, particularly something that is A, controversial, and B, sort of governing our lives right now when it comes to the media and social media and, the access to healthcare and our attitudes to modern day Western medicine and healthcare. Okay. So I'd like to start with the terms informed consent. If you are to break down those terms, you'd say informed consent is when a person gives consent based on being fully informed about the said thing that they're giving consent to, right? So if you are to go out one day, you're at a party, you meet someone really good looking, you're really interested in them, and you have fun, and you're consenting adults, and you decide, I'm gonna go back to his. I'm gonna go and have some fun, or hers, whatever. And that person chooses not to tell you that they have HIV. And you then carry on thinking, oh, you have a presumption in your mind that when you meet someone in a club or you meet someone, who's perfectly fine and getting along with you, don't show any sort of you get comfortable with them and they don't show you any signs that you should sort of red flag, and you carry on, living your life. And then only later to find out, even the following day, to find out that this person allowed you to sleep with them, and knowing full well that they are highly likely to be able to infect you with what once upon a time was known as a deadly disease. But even though it's not a deadly disease, there are various various pieces of information out there that there's a cure for it. There's also information out there that now that people can live with it for many, many years and still live a relatively normal life. So it's something that is now considered fairly easily managed through medication. Interestingly, I have a whole different theory and research base when it comes to the beginnings of that virus particularly. And when I studied it, actually, when I did my A-level biology, which actually is a pretty hard subject. However, going back to the point in course. Okay, so this person says finally the following day or the day after you've come to find out that this, you were not given the consent. If you had been told that that person has HIV or AIDS, that you would not have slept with them, and therefore you were not fully informed, and that as a result of which you haven't actually consented, and therefore that amounts to what we call rape. Okay, because it's a criminal offence for somebody with HIV, particularly in Europe anyway, to sleep with someone without A, notifying them, and B, with the intention of infecting them with said virus. Okay, it's a criminal offence. It's grievous bodily harm, actually. So, now that's an interesting concept for me personally, because I think you are, how can you fully consent to something that you don't know everything about? In especially in the sense of how it affects you. I'm not talking about sleeping with somebody and then you didn't know that, they were cheating before, or they eat foods that you don't agree with, or they, drink or take drugs or whatever. I mean, I'm not talking about that type of stuff that is a behavioral and habitual element to a human being and what they make in their personal, what the choices they make in their personal lives. I'm talking about something that directly would affect you, and affect your health, and would include medicine, right? Because it would include you to have to go and get tests, and it would include you to be on medicine probably for the rest of your life if you do contract the disease. So, bearing that in mind, I'd also like to address the other aspect of consent, which is very much being pushed now, which is, again, is just sort of standard, the patriarchal, misogynistic attitudes that we have today, where men think, and I say men in a broad term, anyone misogynistic can be defined under the term men for argument's sake. Because there are women who are also misogynistic, and we mustn't forget that either, who continue to uphold the patriarchy, whether they know it or not, or they defend something that they fully don't understand. Not because they are not capable of understanding, because I believe we all are. It's because of the way that culturally or, sort of culturally or psychologically, they would have been programmed to believe something and understand something. And sometimes we find ways to defend what we've been taught in order to not deal with the breakdown that may result as a result of feeling like we've been lied to all our lives, which for some people is just too much to take. But so now it's in order to kiss someone, in order to ask someone out, in order to hold someone's hand, in order to any sort of have any sort of erotic, sexual, interaction with someone. Consent is a very big topic right now, especially with the Me Too movement, which, is necessary. Why? Because the patriarchy has allowed for this type of behavior to become normalized. So normalized that people expect it as the said way to be approached, as women and girls have accepted that that type of behavior is something that makes them feel uplifted and that it's a compliment, which is a sad fact of life at the moment. But the beauty about it is changing, and those types of movements, like the Me Too movement, are assisting in that. And so I'd like to carry on and get into what I'm trying to talk about. So my main body of what I'm trying to get at is informed consent, not in just in every single avenue, but particularly when it comes to medicine and medical freedom. Okay, medical freedom is a very big deal. It is, it is life and death. It is also the freedom of choice for you to live your life the way you choose to, or die the way you choose to. And it's not just euthanasia, which a lot of people are fighting for, of course, but it's the idea that if you are not comfortable, because a lot of things are linked to the mind, and once you make a decision that you don't need a particular medication, and I know this might sound a little bit out of whack for people, but this has been proven to be a fact, unfortunately, though a lot of people who are skeptical may not believe this, is that the power of the mind is literally that. It's a power. And there are people who have been able to take themselves off of medication, pharmaceutical drugs in particular, for certain conditions and chronic conditions even, where they've been able to reverse those conditions by diet and changing their mindset alone. And I understand that that might sound a little bit out there for a lot of people. But we can't deny the truth when a human being comes forward and says, "Look, this is what I've done." And it's not one human being, it's hundreds. And hundreds more that we just never hear about, that just don't make the screens, that don't make the juicy media, that in fact have not been bought. So sorry, the media hasn't been bought by. So that's also another thing that we always must remember when it comes to the media, is that there'll always be an element of bias. Not everything can be, not everything that the media provides can be fully accurate and fully true, because if the counter or the opposite argument to that particular point is not. It is basically goes if it goes against it, then you'll have media outlets completely going against the opposite, and we see it a lot. So it was very interesting. The other day there was a discussion about this idea of hashtag fake news, and it's I have to admit it, I never heard that saying until Trump came on stage and started regularly saying, with air quotes, it's fake news. And what I found very interesting, I was listening to a podcast actually called by Collective Consciousness, which was very interesting, and they discussed this idea behind what fake news is and this hashtag fake news. And it was basically brought up that the reason why a lot of things have been brushed under the carpet as fake news is because the information that has been coming to light has been challenging the supremacy and the deception of the global elite. And where that challenge and that seed comes from is the type of information that will eventually lead to a revolution, where people will say, you know, it will be that type of information that keeps getting stored in a bank, and then the straw that broke the camel's back will be another piece of information, and they have to continue to discredit that information, because if they don't, then you know the powers that be will essentially lose their grip on society, which we can see slowly happening actually. Now, when it comes to the pharmaceutical industry, it is one of the most powerful in the world. People call it Big Pharma, and you know I hate that quote, because I hate it when people use that word Big Pharma, like it's almost like conspiracy theory, trigger word, and I really hate that, because what it does is it discredits the actual fact behind that matter, right? Because it's easier, it's better to explain to somebody what you mean by Big Pharma. What we mean by Big Pharma is you have companies like Merck and GSK and Pfizer, and that's just three. Those are three big ones that I can think of at the top of my head that have literally been buying, well, I say buying, but have actually had plots of land. Well, I can speak for GSK for sure. Well, not speak for, I beg your pardon. And then I can definitely link that, which has been proven, to heroin in Afghanistan. A huge plot, like 70% of the poppy seeds, the heroin that was being, you know, taken out of Afghanistan during the supposed intervention, is what was being taken by GSK, which is very interesting, isn't it? So the pharmaceutical industry is obviously very, very powerful. They have been powerful for a very long time. A lot of activists who have gone up against the pharmaceutical industry have been killed. A lot of people are afraid to discuss the doings and the covert operations that the pharmaceutical industry have carried out. What people don't understand is, you know, how you go into, if you imagine you go into Sainsbury's, right, or your local supermarket, Target or something, and you see like countless items on the shelf, yeah, and those items on the shelf would have got there, especially different brands would have got there, because those brands would have people coming pitch for one person to sell, right? For the person who owns that particular supermarket, they'd say, "We want to come in and pitch so that you can sell this item for us and hold it, carry it in your store." So those people would come and give it the best spiel, wouldn't they? They'd be like, "This is the best product. This is how much money you can make from it. This is what, you know, the profit margins are, and you know, we can both come to an agreement that will be mutually beneficial, and you benefit more." Right? That's what they say. That's the incentive. So they'd be selling you bread that costs 10 pence to make, and then they will sell it for 90 pence per loaf. So, very interesting idea, but that's exactly the same as pharmaceutical drugs. That's exactly how they are. They come, the medical sales representatives go around. I used to know one in London, actually, that was her job. So I understand how it works as well. So they would be, they go around to hospitals, NHS, NHS Trust, Bupa, various other private hospitals, and NHS services are different across the whole country. So some regions will have medicines that others won't, and some will buy into certain medicines that other regions won't, even though it's all the NHS. It's very much fragmented into very different management areas. So it's like central government and the local governments all around. It's the same idea, really. So yeah, so that's how it works. Okay. Now, when it comes to vaccines, which brings me very nicely into the deepest concern when it comes to informed consent, is that there are a handful of companies that actually manufacture and produce vaccines, and they are pretty much in correlation with one another across the Western world. Those medicines or those vaccines that actually make it into developing countries are specific, and there are all sorts of experiments and trials, if you like, taking place in different countries for that, for those particular ones, which is also very interesting. Now, because of the nature of this topic vaccines, I will have to provide you with a whole load of resources, which I will be listing out. So excuse me if it doesn't sound, if it sounds scripted at some point, because I will have to read out, because I do not want to get this wrong. I want people to be able to go and make up their own mind and provide a neutral ground of information about something that we have not been providing information for. Okay. My main problem with this issue of information available for vaccines is that every avenue pushes it, and it's only one side. Now, if something comes with risks and side effects, like every single pharmaceutical drug ever created comes with a whole heap of side effects, right? Because our body doesn't recognize it as it's synthetic. That's why there's so many side effects. Whereas if you use homeopathy, it doesn't have side effects. I mean, it's fascinating to me. So as a result of that, I think it's very important that both sides are equally balanced and provided for, because you can't actually fully have informed consent if you haven't been told about the risks of something. And the way that pharmaceutical companies cover themselves with risk associated with drugs is that every drug comes with a lovely insert, full of information such as ingredients and active ingredients and side effects. And there are drugs that are common, very common. Obviously, you've got insulin for diabetics, you've got thyroxine for those who suffer from underactive thyroid. And those are very, very popular medications. When you open the information page that comes in every box, the side effects for thyroxine are the longest I have personally ever seen, except for the side effect list of every vaccination out there, which was very surprising to me personally. There is something that's called a black box warning. And a black box warning is one in which, one that comes with drugs that can pose such a high risk that they could cause a fatality. Now, if you are prescribed something that could result in a fatality, should you be told that that's a possible side effect, in your opinion? You have to think about it and think, would I want to know if something could potentially kill me? I personally would, even though it's horrible. And I've been in a position where I've been told having a particular surgery or having a particular medication could result in, death. And you sort of sign your life away and you're like, okay, I'm gonna have to do it. So it's almost like you make that decision regardless. Yeah, you might decide to go ahead with it anyway, but isn't it right that you are supposed to be told that that could happen? Isn't it right that your next of kin has to be told that that could happen? Especially if you are not in a position to understand your condition, if you're not in a position to consent medically for something that could result in your death or injury. So, yeah, just that, keep in that mind, keep that informed consent and how I'm trying to describe it. Just keep it in mind and go with it, you know, go with me on this. Now, we have got schedules of vaccination schedules around the world. They have been increasing in number as time is going on. They have been adding to it regularly. Some people, particularly those who are not skeptical of the medical industry, will say, "Oh well, you know, that's medical development, technological developments that's allowing that to happen, and we should be very happy about that." That honestly, that is, and that's a fair point. It's a fair comment. It's a fair thought. It is a thought that anyone who is logical and has a conscience would expect that your government or your government, whether it's government owned or not, would have your best interests at heart to the point that you would be protected should you ever end up in the hands of somebody who has to help you for your life or your health. Yes. And that's, you know, a completely natural and normal thing to accept and assume. And it's not really naive to assume that, but I think particularly those who are politically active and politically affiliated, you guys understand that, you know, the government doesn't do things for the sake of the people. And you must know that, surely. And, you know, there's a history, thousands of years of history where this is apparent. And the past couple of hundred years, this has been more and more apparent. The last 500 years, we've had transatlantic slavery, we've had colonization, we've had, you know, which we've had massacres and genocides and holocausts, not just one, by the way. So we've had all of that happen, all under government rule, all under the say-so of the government. You know, so I think it's fair to say that we have evidence that the government hasn't got our interests at heart. We in the UK here have had, in the past 3 years alone, hundreds of deaths because the Department for Work and Pensions, if you didn't want to pay out benefits to someone who had had a stroke and was disabled and was then forced and signed off to re as a result of a new system called Universal Credit, was signed off to return to work and was not entitled to any benefits whatsoever to support them because they were signed off and then they died because their body couldn't handle it. And that sort of tragedy is what's going on under the watch of the government, the duty of care that's owed to us as citizens of said government isn't being extended. And there are people suing the government for this, and rightly so. And I hope they win because, unfortunately, unless you're working in this industry within, you know, law and I guess you could say some elements of politics, you wouldn't really hear about these types of cases actually going to court. You know, I know that they get settled a lot. Why? Because it's stressful for a mourning family to have to continually battle to battle a multi-million pound, you know, strategy. It's just, it's hard work. And it's asking a lot of a person. So I don't expect that, that I don't expect that that's going to be that's going to happen. So luckily they get away with it a lot, because if something hasn't gone to court, it's you can make it go away. If something goes to court, then it's in the public interest, and therefore it can't go away. So they make very generous offers, particularly the NHS and the NHS what's it called? It's a fund that's created for NHS for those who claim against medical negligence. And that fund is used to pay people off, basically, because having studied medical negligence at a professional level, and being taught by a professional negligence, a barrister, she made it very clear, like, these cases don't get to court. This is her specialty. She was a doctor and she turned a lawyer. And she made it very clear how it all works. And, I spent 3 years studying that on and off. And I remember thinking, why didn't, looking through the legal database to back up certain assertions that I will have made at the time, why didn't this go to court? Why didn't this make it to court? And it was always sort of like liability, 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 and you have to constantly think like that. And the way that you end up developing your thought process is helpful, because it helps you to come to conclusions that are very different to others. But it's it's very interesting. So a lot of these cases don't get to court, but I have to bring the our friends over the pond and their work when it comes to vaccines into this episode. So, the vitamin K shot, which is the first vaccine that's ever offered to a baby when they're born, is one that comes with what I mentioned earlier, which is a black box warning. There are a lot of children in the United States who die within the first 4 days of birth. There is no explanation for those deaths. A lot of people have been saying that those deaths occur as a result of the vaccines that are given to children, to babies in America. They were given two, which is a vitamin K shot, which is not a vaccine, it's a shot. And then the vaccine is the hepatitis B. Now, the hepatitis B is one that's given to people who are heroin addicts, users, or use needles for whatever reason. And women in prostitution, or those who are in some type of work that is classed as something that is now known as sex work, which I also disagree with that. I disagree with that definition, but let's go with it. So, why does a newborn baby require a hepatitis B vaccine? And that's where a lot of questions are coming in, because that's not actually a compulsory vaccination in Europe, and we don't have it at all in the UK for newborn babies. It is offered to babies, but it's offered as part of a different cocktail of vaccines. So it's very, very interesting how it's offered in America, and America has got the highest rate of infantile death in the world, which is surprising, given there's a whole bunch of extremely poor countries with very little sanitary conditions, very difficult issues when it comes to hygiene and healthcare. which they don't have access to. They don't have access to clean water. And so, that's an interesting thing to keep in mind. Now, I think that if we are to discuss vaccines, I will have to make sure that I am providing you with a not sort of a unbiased view of it. And I don't want to come across like I'm biased because, to be honest, I feel that I can easily explain both sides. So yeah, which is what I'd like to do. I'd like us to be able to think about something critically without being offended by it. I'd like us to be able to think about something critically, which are in reference to studies that are done by and outside the medical field, by doctors, by medical scientists, by biologists, by immunologists, by those who do design and manufacture vaccines, and there's so many groups of people who look into this, so I will definitely be bringing them all into the topic, and I will go through each vaccine with you, with references and sources as to where this information is from. So for the second half of this episode, I'd like to continue further in with a more focused aspect of informed consent, in the for, under the sort of medical and healthcare sectors. And I am going to go into vaccines because currently it is pretty big in the media, particularly for those in America. And it's causing a bit of a storm, really, even here in the UK. Where it's not mandatory, where it's not sort of a legal requirement for people to have vaccines. Mainly because, or any medical intervention, to be honest, mainly because we have NGOs that work to ensure that we have our rights protected, that we are able to exercise autonomy when it comes to our health and well-being. What's interesting is the more I go into further into depth with all the issues, facts, figures, cases surrounding vaccines, and why it's become so controversial, is with information from all the sources that are pro-vaccine, and also those that license, push, and promote, administer, and sign off on the safety of vaccines. So I will be referring to the Centre for Disease Control and Prevention and their advice, their particular pieces of advice when it comes to who should be vaccinated and who shouldn't be, because even there's not a single medical professional who understands immunology that will say that everyone needs to be vaccinated. There's not a single doctor even that can make that claim. So there are, huge numbers of the world's population who cannot be vaccinated. Okay. And it's not just babies and people who are immunocompromised. So people who have a very low immune system, maybe. Those going through chemotherapy, babies, others who are continually get sick, so the immune system's constantly fighting. They're just as much under threat as those who might have severe cases of sickle cell anemia, those who may have a whole sort of list of ailments and illnesses that constantly sort of feed off of each other. So they might end up, people who end up having cold after cold and virus after virus and just sort of don't end up catching the break they need to build their immune system. And those people are also classed as immunocompromised, although under the standard heading, when you speak to a medical professional and they advise you as to whether or not you are immunocompromised, they will not, probably not include those people as part of the definition. I'd like to just add also that I have got a history of medical negligence research. I did also have that as my elective, during my professional qualification. I also worked with and volunteered with a lawyer who was a medical negligence lawyer. We did a lot of research for this person. I had to look through databases of countless cases in relation to particular diseases and sicknesses as to what steps were taken for those people when it comes to the medical professionals in question. My current role is also in healthcare regulation. And although it's not necessarily fully medical negligence, there are elements of it that may come into question when it comes to certain things that that my particular role deals with, some of which is classed as medical negligence. So yeah, just to give you a bit of a background as to where I'm coming from. It's not just something that I've Googled, because for some reason people tend to hate those who provide information via Google. But what's very interesting is if you go into a general practitioner surgery or a standard doctor, they also Google. Did you know that? I've seen it with my own eyes, by the way. And a lot of people have seen it too. They also Google. And even in medical school, a lot of people are, you're told about all kinds of symptoms. A lot of symptoms for a lot of viruses are exactly the same. It is guesswork a lot of the time. It's not always absolute. Doctors get it wrong all the time. And they don't always pretend that they don't get it wrong. We just assume that they get it right. And that's where I think the public, or patients rather, often feel hard done by when a huge mistake is made, because they're not held to account. And there's also this element of God complex, a God complex that comes with being a doctor, where people sort of put on you that they sort of assume that you're going to somehow save them. Like there's this idea of being saved and cured and healed. And that's something that, in terms of biblical, in terms of the biblical sense, is sort of God's job. So a lot of people do associate it with that. And it's interesting how society is structured and how we often always go back to that idea of being saved by something, and cured. And actually, preventative medicine is still the best way to avoid getting sick and having these huge, huge sort of levels of chronic diseases that we have in the West and we see a peak of. I think that it's unfortunate that we're still living in that bubble where we believe that our idea of healthcare, whether it be private hospital care under medical insurance that's paid for privately, or whether it's paid for by your taxes under the National Health Service model that a lot of welfare states in Europe have, it's quite interesting that we assume that this is the only sort of form of medicine and healthcare that's truly available, when actually the vast majority of the world, that's right, the vast majority of the world still use herbal medicine, homeopathy, and acupuncture, traditional Chinese medicine, Ayurvedic medicine, and live off of that, live incredibly long lives. Some of the people with the longest, who've lived the longest to date, were completely unvaccinated, were completely using herbal medicine and homeopathy and plenty of fresh air. So, and that's just a fact. That's not something I've made up. That's not, that's probably available on Google even, because a lot of people, do seem to have an issue with people who are called Google doctors now. So they say, oh, there's like this meme going around on social media about, don't confuse my medical degree with your Google search. And it's sort of like, but why do people feel like they can say that? Why is it that, and there's a doctor who I do follow on my Instagram. She's brilliant. And she's like, look, we don't live in a society where you can't have access to what medical, practitioners use. You can have access to that. You can read that. You can analyze that. You can question that. And when we are placed in a society where we're told we can't question something, that's really dangerous, isn't it? That's essentially what a lot of agnostics and atheists argue about religion, why they hate religion so much as well, is the idea that nothing can be questioned and, people are often sort of blindly following along. But a lot of those same people don't seem to want to extend that mentality when it comes to, the medical practitioners and the medical field, particularly in the West, which is really is beyond me. I personally would rather use a homeopathic medication, which has little to no side effects, versus a pharmaceutical drug, which has a whole list of side effects, which they do, and try it to see if it works for me. If it works, then why take one that's going to cause me more harm, which then results in me taking other medicines to stop the side effects of that one medicine, and then the next medicine also has another list of side effects. And in my role, I ended up seeing patients who had literally a list as long as your arm of medicine, of prescriptions they had to pick up weekly. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine living a life where, as a result of one medicine or drug, you have to take another seven for the rest of your life, all of your life? And the health impacts that has, slowly there are more and more psychologists and psychiatrists and different types of scientists, not just biologists and, microbiologists and biomedical scientists who are finding out this information, but they're coming from all segments of science. Who are finding more and more issues and things wrong with the way that the current system is going and the way in which people are prescribed certain drugs. And it's absolutely not a preventative method. We have a curative idea behind medicine and the fact that, there's like a cure available. Oh, this vaccine will mean you'll be absolutely fine for the rest of your life, when it's actually a complete fallacy. It's absolutely wrong. It's a myth, because actually, even the Centre for Disease Control and Prevention, which I will probably end up doing quite a segment on, discuss the fact that the vaccines are not lifelong immunity, they're temporary immunity, and they also fall into the category of something they call in the medical field, artificial immunity. Okay, so there's artificial immunity and natural immunity, and of course, natural immunity is the best thing for you because it means your body recognizes it and will continue to recognize it for the rest of your life. And that's not something you get with artificial immunity. Right, so that's something to bear in mind when we're discussing what this all of these points actually mean and how they come together. And the reason why I'm actually going into depth with this is the fact that currently we have a complete imbalance when it comes to the evidence available and the information available for parents and just standard human beings to make a choice and understand what it means to not be able to have access to both sides of what a medicine actually does, what the side effects can be, what the repercussions can be. You know, it's so fascinating to me how you can go in for a medical procedure, whether it be your wisdom tooth dental, you know, dental procedure with a wisdom tooth removal, or an abdominal operation, where they'll go through everything and they'll say, well, you could die. That's one of the potential side effects of this procedure, you know, which I find sort of quite horrific, really. But they don't want to extend the same caution when it comes to things that also have a record of causing death, like vaccines. And that to me is quite it's quite sort of disturbing, really, because because it's showing that there is a huge censoring of information that could assist you in making a decision whether something is right for you or not. Because we cannot, absolutely cannot use the one size fits all method when it comes to medicine. Even when you take insulin or thyroxine or iron, even, every person will be given what is needed by their body. And when that happens, it's less likely that you will have too much of something in your body that will cause your body to need to excrete it out of your system, for example. Like iron, take iron tablets. You know, that's one way. You know, too much iron is not good for you. It's all about balance in your body. So if I have severely low iron, then I'm going to need a high, very high dosage to get the levels back up to an optimal level. But if I have a very high, if I have an average level of iron, but not optimal, and I want to get it, push it up to the optimal, the best level I can have, then I just take a little bit more to ensure that it reaches and surpasses that level. So it should be exactly the same thing for vaccines, because we're all different sizes, we're all different shapes, and we all have different family history, hereditary diseases, if there are any, and a whole list of reasons as to why the Centre for Disease Control and Prevention advise certain people not to be vaccinated. Okay, which is something I will absolutely have to go into in order to present to you a balanced view as to what's going on, because currently the view is, as I said, completely imbalanced and completely pro something. And the issue with that is that when something poses a potential risk and has side effects and therefore cannot be deemed absolutely safe for everybody, we have to be able to question that, and we have to be able to say no to that. Okay, because otherwise that's robbing you of your medical freedom, and that's something that in short, that we are entering a very, very dangerous phase of our lifetime on Earth, because it means that we will have given our government absolutely every ounce of power over us. And I think those who are skeptical of the government and who have seen the amount of wrongdoing governments have done over the past, let's say, 700 years, then I think it would be rather naive to believe that somehow government-funded, government-sourced, backed, lobbied information is somehow only providing half of the facts. And that's not something that I personally am comfortable with. I think if I am to be given all of the information and then I still decide to go ahead with something, then that's on me. But if I'm not given everything, I believe I am given all the truth, and then I discover I'm not after a mishap, then I will have been, you know, robbed of my freedom and my ability to think. And that is what happens to people who are sectioned under the Mental Health Act. They take away your freedom so that they can medicate you as how and however they want, with whatever they want and whatever dosage they want. And you're not allowed to say no to that. That's what a section under the Mental Health Act allows to happen to you. Okay. And the way I see it is mental health institutions, particularly in this country, I mean, there is more and more a focus on that, which is good, and more support and understanding and trying to unravel the years of taboo that's been built surrounding mental health. However, it's still currently a cross between a hospital and a prison, and that is something that I'm not sure particularly assists those in that situation. However, I digress. Coming back to the vaccine, so I'd like to say that I will be providing you with a whole list of resources to research for yourselves, which is very, very important to do, because every decision you make, and actually, you know, I've been in positions where I have made decisions, having weighed up the facts, knowing that there are more negatives than positives, but I personally felt that the positives are something that I was happy to take a gamble with. So even with the extra negative, I've still taken those kind of choices before. So, you know, please don't assume that this is some type of bid to switch over and go to another side. That's not the case. This is purely a neutral perspective to allow people to ensure that they have understood why, A, that there is backlash when it comes to forced vaccinations, B, why it's so crucial to ensure that people are allowed a freedom, the freedom to have the choice over their, you know, over medical treatment and their health and lives, and see that that you're able to go away and have sources that you can actually look at, because there's a lot of censoring going on at the moment, where a lot of platforms have removed anything that's questioning the positive element of vaccinations. From Pinterest, who've completely removed anything to do with vaccinations, from Facebook, who are really trying to crack down hard on it, to Etsy, who has actually banned somebody for selling a bracelet that stated question vaccines, and it continues. And the next will be YouTube, and then eventually we'll be in a position where we will have been completely overtaken by propaganda, which is what you'd call it in a war, and this would result in war, a war on people's human rights to medical freedom. So yeah, it's a very worrying time, and I hope that my episodes will enable you to understand why people are so frustrated by this. Instead of sharing memes and Facebook posts about people's children encountering measles and all sorts. So that's, you know, something that I will definitely go further into my next episode. But currently, I think I will have to pick a few studies for you from critical vaccine studies. And the reason I like Miller's Review of Critical Vaccine Studies, which is a fantastic book by a doctor, is the fact that he is fairly neutral in his findings and suggests things to fix the vaccine, instead of saying, no, I'm anti-vaccine. You know, he sort of puts things into perspective and says, if you completely remove this heavy metal from the said vaccine, then it might prove to be relatively safe. Okay. And that's reassuring, because what I think is dangerous when it comes to taking sides of something is when you fully don't understand the other side. I think that's quite dangerous. And sometimes we might never understand something fully, but in order to be able to even attempt to understand something fully, you do need to be able to be presented with both sides, which I'm yet to see a single person actually who can get quite abusive and troll-like online when it comes to questioning vaccines, and the pro-vaccine element of things. I think it's very, very important that we are able to bring those questions to the forefront. And instead of being rude and mean and bullish, I think we should be able to have real discussions and proper discussions and be able to speak to parents who are campaigning for this right because they have lost their child directly after a side effect of a vaccine. People, for some reason, completely do not wish to understand that, and it's a psychological thing. It's to do with the fact that we've been programmed to believe something's good, and therefore, no matter what anyone says, we don't want to accept the fact that it may be bad. A lot of religious people are like that too. They feel that their religion can do no bad, even though it will tell you directly that this particular religion might say that it allows you to do a lot of things, and that having multiple partners is completely fine, and killing someone for revenge, not justice, is completely fine, and it might tell you all types of things, but and society may say it's wrong. Like capital punishment is a good example, but if you believe in it, then you will make yourself understand that no, it's still a good thing. And we have the same belief when it comes to vaccines, because there's the God complex element of the medical profession really sort of pushes that on us, to be honest. So I will continue my next one with my next episode with an introduction to a lot of the resources, a lot of sources, studies, books, and last but by no means least, the Centre for Disease Control and Prevention, which is basically the I'd like to say, I want to use the word God. It's like the lawmaker of vaccines and the administrator and the advertiser and the caution at the same time. So it works as a very, very, very important, it has a very, very important role when it comes to medicine, and particularly vaccines. Thank you so much for listening. I hope that this is something that interests you. If it doesn't, please feel free to share with those who might be interested in vaccines, particularly parents, and those who may or may not be affected by someone who's been recently vaccinated, or those who are older and are often offered the flu vaccine. Thank you again for listening, and I will be back with my next episode very soon. Hi guys, and welcome to another episode of Tyra Talks. Today, I will be discussing the first in-depth episode on vaccines, in particular regarding informed consent, as previously mentioned in my last episode. I will be looking at. I have to introduce everything slowly and thoroughly, just so that people are able to get a pen and paper ready and write down these organizations and what I'm saying and the sources that I'm discussing, so that you can go and do your own research. Of course, when it comes to informed consent, it's also very important that although I am happy to discuss this and provide information that I have found from my research, that it's exceptionally important that you do your own, so that you are responsible and empowered to guide yourself when it comes to your and your family's health, which of course is probably the most important thing in this life. A lot of people think it's other things until something happens, and then you just immediately miss that part of you that was perfect before. So something as little as having a mouth ulcer or burning your finger slightly on the, when you're taking out something from the oven, you immediately realize just how sort of important and wonderful our bodies are, and health really is. So, the main organisations I'll be mentioning today are the following: the CDC, which is the Centre for Disease Control and Prevention, which is US based, but is a huge influence globally. The FDA, which is again US based, the Food and Drugs Administration. ASDA, US Department of Agriculture. Public Health England. European Centre for Disease Prevention and Control, ECDC. National Health Federation, which is a non-profit organisation based in the UK for that advocates for the rights of people to have informed consent, and often very, very much heavily involved with healthcare professionals, healthcare regulation, and on top of all the legislation and recommendations that are being passed from our Department of Health, basically, which is extremely important. I didn't understand their role until I began my research. I'll also be looking at the General Medical Council, which is a regulator for doctors. The Medicine and Healthcare Regulatory Agency, which is also known as the MHRA. The purpose, they govern pharmaceuticals and drugs. The purpose of, regulatory bodies like the General Medical Council and the Medicine and Healthcare Regulatory Agency is first and foremost impartiality. I've worked in financial and healthcare regulation for the past 7 years, and the most important thing, apart from impartiality, is that the welfare of the public is its core duty. That's often why these organizations are set up. Quasi-governmental, in a way, is probably the best way to describe their model, and to also, I suppose, bring to light the fact that the reason why they were set up and the essence of their existence is to help the public and protect the public. However, the reason why I had to mention this is because the Medicine and Healthcare Regulatory Agency is one regulator that has been accused by our very own government, the House of Commons Select Committee on Health, of being corrupt. The Lancet Medical Journal and a BBC Panorama programme. For those who don't know what Panorama is, it's often investigative journalism that sort of looks into a lot of injustices that take place within the UK and abroad as well sometimes, but we do f it is focused mainly on the UK, and it brings to light the issues that the public may not have been aware of but actually are directly impacted by. And in a sense, it allows people to be armed with the knowledge that they need to make sure that they are not short-changed or misinformed or treated badly, essentially. And BBC Panorama also supports this assertion of corruption against the MHRA. There's a website called mhrafraud.co.uk which provides links to all the reports that prove this. And there was a petition, and a petition that is still up today, which was signed by 10,000 people to disband the MHRA in 2015. And because of sort of the time, that's a lot of people, because I'm not sure about you, my listeners, but you probably haven't even heard of them, the MHRA. I mean, I certainly hadn't until I started working in the same industry of healthcare regulation. There is something else. Although my main focus for this episode
And the next one, and possibly another one, will be vaccinations, because it's obviously a very hot topic. So people are incredibly disturbed by it. There's a lot of issues involved with regarding what actually is going on. And so I just wanted to make sure that I present the facts as they are. And if anyone wants to know my personal views on it, I'll be happy to discuss them one-on-one via my Instagram if necessary. But there is something else that I wanted to raise, because I did initially think that I was going to do a podcast on this, which I still might, and it's called the Cancer Act 1939. So yes, don't know if you've ever thought this before, but can you imagine that there is one sickness or disease that, the big C word, that is common now? You can say it's quite a common disease. And in 1939, our government passed a law regarding this sickness. Now, I just want you to sort of just think about this, because when I first discovered that there was something called the Cancer Act back in 2009, I was quite shocked. I was thinking, why is that the only sickness with its own act? And for those who are legally minded, I mean, if you've even heard of it, because some people actually don't know about this, the existence of this act, and the fact that, you don't get the Diabetes Act. So, it's very interesting. So essentially, the Cancer Act, what it does is it makes it illegal to discuss the possibility of a cancer cure. It also means that no scientist, even if they have, can claim that they found the cure for a cancer. And I find that quite disturbing, because it's sort of, we have the Cancer Research UK, which is regularly fundraising, regularly making, millions a year. And we are supposedly one of the countries that provides the least funding in Europe for cancer research. But yet, we still have this act that disallows somebody from being able to, prohibits is probably a stronger word, the correct word, to even be able to come forth and discuss any findings. If anybody even asserts that they have a cure for cancer or have cured themselves of cancer by the usage of something natural, for example, they can be prosecuted, and therefore must say, "I don't believe that this cures it," or they can say the very bare minimum, or maximum, if you like, is they can say is that this can help prevent cancer. That type of thing. You can never say something is a cure, which is very interesting, given that chemotherapy itself is actually based on herbal medicine, as is the majority of synthetic medication that's created. Initially came from a the seed of it initially came from something natural, plant or a herb, or well, herb and plant is the same thing, but herb or bark or something that's been found in nature. And in order for it to be made widely available, it's needed to go through many processes of many processes that basically synthesize and create a different version that tries to emulate what that initial version tried to do. Sometimes it's created far weaker or for a reason, because we don't, our medical model in the West is not prevention based. It's supposed to be cure based, but again, you're not allowed to call for, particularly for cancer, you're not allowed to call anything a cure. So we're in a bit of, it's a bit of a double-edged sword when it comes to this particular sickness. Okay, so and now that I've introduced the sources, I will for the next part of the podcast go into the schedule, and I will also be going in. But before I do that, there is one other thing that I would like to add, which is that, as I mentioned to you earlier, that we have our European version of the Centre for Disease Control and Prevention centres, and in on the 7th of December 2018, an EU Council recommendation was published, and it is based on the strengthened cooperation against vaccine preventable diseases. So, as you may be aware, it's been on the news a lot. There's been a lot of fear-mongering. There's been a lot of there's been a lot of criticizing of activists and supposedly people online, also even health professionals and doctors with decades of experience have also been called, for lack of a better word, quacks, and they've been called out as being ill-informed and all types of threatening behaviors used towards them. Their sort of published works have been censored off, excuse me, off the internet, and various other attempts to block the other side being able to express what it is that they're trying to say without being completely bombarded with abuse. On the side of the pro-vaccine debate versus the anti-vaccine debate, whereas there was a fantastic article that I had read that said that actually most people are not on either extreme of the debate. And it's true with most things in life. Not many people are on the extreme side of either, you know, especially those who actually end up doing the research and doing the work to find out more about it. Because unfortunately, we live in a very fast-paced world, and it's difficult to balance life and family and work and social time. And not many people have the passion or even the concern enough to take hours out of their day to do research like this, because I can absolutely promise you it is utterly time consuming, and it does take a lot of dedication. And for someone like myself, who, well, I get passionate about things, and I want to find out, and therefore it becomes almost not an escape, but something that I don't mind doing. I sometimes enjoy learning about things like this, particularly something that can affect everyone's lives, you know. And so I and because I need to learn things all the time, it's something that I find quite refreshing to dedicate myself to, although it takes a lot of time and effort, and therefore I appreciate that. And that's why I felt even more that it's important that some information is put out here that shows that balances the suggestions that are out there right now. So, the first point of this of the recommendation of the council, it says, pursuant to Article 168 of the Treaty of Functioning of the European Union, a high level of human health protection is to be ensured in the definition and implementation of all union policies and activities. Union action, which is to complement national policies, is to be directed towards improving public health, preventing physical and mental illness and disease, and obviating sources of danger to physical and mental health. Now, the the fourth point paragraph says, so it says, while vaccination programs are the responsibility of member states, the cross-border nature of vaccine preventable diseases and the common challenges faced by national immunization programs would benefit from more coordinated EU action and approaches to preventing or limiting the spread of epidemics and diseases with a cross-border dimension. Now, this has come from the fact that there are a number of EU member states, Poland, Italy, Romania in particular, that have had issues with vaccine injuries, as well as the government or certain people as part of the government trying to force vaccines to become part of a program that every child, no matter what, must receive. Now, the reason why there's a lot of backlash is that there clearly has been, according to the vaccine injury reporting system, a reporting system that's available in the US, that is monitored by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, called the VIAS system, which has had hundreds of thousands of reported vaccine injuries, and what's classed as a vaccine injury. So when you know, there are side effects straight after a vaccine, so a rash and vomiting and not eating and too much of heavy sleep and all of those things that are deemed normal are actually side effects that should be reported. And there are also a lot of parents take their children in, babies in particularly, to emergency care straight after, because they drastically change and go through, you know, all of these side effects, rashes, etc., which obviously is very troubling to a mother or a father to witness. And often people get very frightened and take them along to have them checked out, as you naturally would. That's just part of, you know, your first reaction. So now what I'd like to add, though, is that I don't know if you know much about activism and political activism or any type of activism, whether it's for a feminine cause or whether it's to do with the transgender rights, whether it's to do with immigration or refugee rights, anything, or if it's to do with an anti-war situation, or if it's to do with assisting people who have been falsely imprisoned around the world, whether it's someone on death row who clearly doesn't deserve to be there, and therefore people campaign and create campaign groups and strong advocates and advocate for those people's rights, right? And that's part of their activism, to say, look, we need to raise awareness because this is not right. This has happened and that's happened. And people create these groups because there is a reason to create those groups. It's not just something that they, you know, funnel out of thin air and think, I'm just going to spend, you know, my time being miserable and go through a very difficult, because often these campaigns are difficult because you have to learn about often very emotional issues and injustices. And I'm talking now about, I'm not talking about anything in this particular thing when it comes to vaccines. I'm talking about in general, when it comes to campaigns and activism, it's often to do with quite something that's affects people significantly enough for somebody to lose sleep, for somebody to sacrifice family time, for somebody to take out time of their day to miss, you know, a trip or miss an episode of their favorite show, to research, to read, to speak to someone, to, you know, create documents to spread online, to update, you know, to tweet or to update their blog or whatever it might be. So I just want you to keep that in mind whilst I read the next part of this report, which is paragraph 5, which says, The rapid spread of misinformation through social media and by vocal anti-vaccination activists has fueled misconceptions that are shifting the public focus away from the individual and collective benefits of vaccination and the risks posed by communicable diseases and towards increased distrust and fears of unproven adverse effect events. Action is needed to strengthen dialogue with citizens, to understand their genuine concerns and doubts about vaccination, and to adequately address these issues on the basis of individual needs. And what I find quite interesting about this paragraph is the fact that it's saying that this campaign to bring more information to the public, this campaign to show that there are parents who have lost their children immediately after vaccinations, routine vaccinations, have come forward to essentially become activists, to say that we're not the only ones, you know, going through this. Yet we have the EU Council, along with the media, saying that these activists are spreading misinformation, completely trying to discredit the existence of a group of people or even individuals who are coming forward to say that something is dangerous or something has caused enough of a stir for people to come together and say, no, sorry, this is not okay, this is not what you say it is. And this is where I think we really need to stick our hats on and focus, because that's a very dangerous thing, isn't it? To say that, oh, your campaign means nothing, you just, what you're saying is not true. Whereas almost every other campaign in history, other than campaigns for example, human rights issues in China, where the government point blank denies any human rights atrocities are taking place and completely just sort of pretends they don't exist. Aside from that level of, you know, disagreement with and sort of oblivion, it's like I've not heard of any other type of campaign be ridiculed the way that this particular one is being at the moment. So I will come back with the next one. We'll go through the schedule of vaccines, what they mean, ingredients lists, and the groups of people who often don't vaccinate and haven't done for decades. So stay tuned for the next bit and enjoy the music.